Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
And Dr. Umat has the weekend off. Dr. Jerry Mixon here. I'm Lynette, and we're talking with Ben about hormone levels in men.
Right. Yeah, my thinking has changed on a couple of levels. One is on the estrogen that you're specifically asking about, and the other is on progesterone, but I'll get to that in a bit. What we have found in this ensuing decades is that estrogen is a very powerful anti-inflammatory agent, and it affects the entire body. We know, for instance, that robust estrogen levels lower the risk of colon cancer by about 40%. So, you know, colon cancer is one of the big killers in older men. So I'd like to decrease as much inflammation in the bowel as I possibly can. And estrogen is quite effective at that. Also, estrogen helps the brain, the inflammation in the brain. And so people with good estrogen levels, tend to think better. They have better verbal skills and better verbal abilities. So we get a lot of older men that are starting to search for words and search for content, but higher estrogen levels can actually help that. Estrogen is very helpful at decreasing scarring and degeneration in the skin. So older guys that are subject to injuries or surgical interventions of any kind find that they often heal better with less scarring and less inflammation if their estrogen level's a little higher. So I stopped being quite as obsessive about trying to push estrogen levels down. It's now pretty rare for us to use an aromatase inhibitor in men. My big function in men these days is to say, okay, let's get as much body fat off as we possibly can. And those lean bodies naturally will make less estrogen. But I want them to have enough to decrease the inflammation, to lower the risk of colon cancer, to lower the risk of heart disease, to lower the risk of dementia. And so I'm not pushing estrogens down as much as I used to. So it depends to some extent on the individual. If he's really overweight and I become convinced that he's converting a lot of his testosterone into estrogen, I may use low doses of aromatase inhibitor to damp it down somewhat, but not as often as I used to, because I think the benefits of estrogen in many men at least come to a balance point with the downsides. Does that answer your question?
So what would be roughly and a good number to have?
Well, again,
the lab test.
It's going to it has to be individualized. We aren't treating the laboratory, we're treating the individual, okay? So it comes down to the doctor's evaluation for this particular person. I'm very comfortable with estrogens in the 30s, even the low 40s, but I still get nervous if I see estrogens up in the 50s and 60s. So,
and you don't like it at 15 or 17?
No, I'm not shooting for 15 or 17 because then I'm losing the anti-inflammatory effect And so, you know, testosterone and estrogen are both anti-inflammatories. Testosterone decreases inflammation in blood vessels, in skeletal muscle and ligaments and tendons and so on. So testosterone helps us not to get sore, not to get inflamed in our joints, ligaments, and tendons. Estrogen helps us in our soft organs, such as our colon and our brains. So we need them both. The question is, what is the balance we're shooting for within an individual? And one of the things that I really, really have to emphasize with my physicians when I'm teaching them and training them is it's your judgment. You're looking not at a group. Remember, numbers and statistics apply to populations, not so much to individuals. And you're treating one patient with each office visit, and you're looking at this one person. And where's that balance? And that's what I want our docs to kind of keep a hold of. The reason we have hour-long visits is I want my doctors to really know their patients, to understand their patients, to understand their lifestyle, their benefits, their risks, and to customize the program to what that individual needs. So when someone like you asks me, what is the right number? The right number for me is probably not the right number for you. You know? And it's probably not for your Uncle Fred. That's why this is a program administered by physicians who specialize in this for each individual patient, not something you can do a mass market for.
I appreciate it very much.
All right, so
yes,
take
it
care.
Does.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call, Ben. All right, we are headed to Redmond, not too far away. Hilmer is on the line. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine, Hilmer. Welcome.
Hello, Hilmer. How can I help?
Well, it's the usual subject, rapamycin, but in related to shingles.
Okay.
A couple of weeks ago, I got the sensation of why is my whole mouth falling apart? Why am I getting cavities everywhere at the same time? And I go, that doesn't make any sense. So I wound up going to the dentist, and the dentist, they took x-rays, and they looked up in there, up in my mouth, and they said, well, you got shingles.
Uh-huh.
And I go, what?
Yeah,
you got shingles. And so, because I was brushing my teeth, and it was like, I go, what's going on here? I was like hitting certain spots, sure. And it was like, felt very sensitive. So basically, they just sent me home, and basically you got to write it out. I got a hold of some Acyclovir.
Good.
And started chewing on the 800 milligrams a day for a few days, and now it's just about gone. Now, however, when I discovered this, I decided maybe I shouldn't be taking rapamycin with the shingles going on. And so I've skipped rapamycin now for, well, this could be 3 weeks now coming up on next week. I was planning on start taking it again next week, but I didn't want to experiment with taking an immune-modifying drug, rapamycin, and introducing it to my body while I'm having shingles. So what's your take on it?
Well, you know, we've talked about rapamycin several times, and you've alluded to the right thoughts, and that is rapamycin is, in low doses, is extremely beneficial. In the animal studies, the higher the dose, the longer the lifespan, the healthier the animals. That's a benefit. So, you know, we like to push the dose as much as practical. The downside is that if the dose gets too high, you start suppressing sirtuin 2, and that suppresses immune response. you know, we older people are subject to shingles because our immune response is overall declining compared to our youth. And that's why those chickenpox viruses often will become resurgent and give us shingles. So, you know, I can't argue with your reasoning. I would also have held up on my rapamycin if I developed shingles. On the other hand, I wish everybody to go out and get their shingles vaccine, you know, the Shingrix, so that they don't have to worry about shingles. Get your immune system boosted for that particular virus again. The shot should not be taken while you've got an active outbreak, but I'd let it resolve for 6 months and then make sure you go get your shots, okay? Protect yourself against the shingles. In the meantime, I'd probably get a couple, two or three more weeks. I'd let that clinical outbreak completely resolve for maybe a full month before I went back on the rapamycin. And I'd start with a modest dose, and I'd probably go get my shingles shot just before I went back on the rapamycin. You know, it's going to take about 2 weeks after the shot for your immunity to really develop. So let this resolve completely, get your shingles vaccine, and then go ahead and go back on your rapamycin. But start low, go slow, make sure that you're tolerating it well and you're not suppressing your immune response. The question is, at what point does your immune response get suppressed? The downside here is the tests that we do for immune, to test how robust our immune response is, are not normally covered by insurance unless you have an immune deficiency disease of some sort. So if you had HIV, your insurance would cover testing your immune system. But if you don't, and you don't have any sort of genetic problem associated with it, you're probably looking at around $800 out of pocket for every time you do the test. So, you know, it's a significant hit. And so most people have never tested immune response. I'm currently talking with an immune testing laboratory because I'm interested in redeveloping the thymus, the gland that produces our innate immunity and our resistance to disease and infections and cancers. Because our thymus function in older people is almost zip. But there are now some studies showing that we may be able to help your thymus, even in old age, start growing again and redeveloping immune responses that we thought we had lost once we were past 50. So I'm using some protocols and a few people, and then I want to be testing their immune response. And for the first few, I intend to eat the cost myself as part of my studies and my education. But yeah, that's the question. What dose of rapamycin will start suppressing your immune response? As long as you're down around 4 to 6 milligrams a week, you're probably pretty safe, you know. My personal one, I'm up around six. You're a six?
Yeah. I've been doing six a week, yeah.
Yeah, and six a week is about as high as most people are carrying patients. Personally, I carry my own around 12, but then I've always been a bit of a risk taker, so.
All right. So how long after you take the Shingrix shot, how long do you have to wait?
I'd give it 2 weeks.
After you take that?
Yeah, at 2 weeks at least. Yeah, 2 weeks.
Okay.
2 weeks, you'll get a pretty good response from your injection for your immunity.
And then how long after I have, I have no symptoms anymore. So how long after I have no symptoms do I have to wait until I take the shot?
I'd give it at least another 2 weeks after you're totally symptom-free. Okay?
Okay. Very good.
All right.
All righty.
Take care, my friend.
Thank you so much, Hilmer.
Bye-bye.
All right. The music says we're going to take a quick break.
It does indeed.
And we'll be back with more of your phone calls. Phone lines are open. 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. We'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine in a moment.
right.
We're back.
I can't do those high notes.
You're not doing those. Not today.
No, not falsetto.
Welcome back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Lynette here, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon. Dr. Samira Umat has the weekend off this first weekend of January. All right. The phones keep ringing, so we'll keep answering them. And we have room for your questions, too, if you call quick. 1-800-465-8770. We're headed to Seattle. We have Richard on the line. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine, Richard.
Hello, Richard.
Welcome, and thank you for the service you provide to our citizenry.
Well, thank you, sir. It's a privilege.
Thank you. I'm an avid blood donor. I've been donating blood since I was stationed at McCord Air Force Base in 1962.
Okay.
I'm approaching 100 gallons. And
right.
The last three attempts I've made, they've not taken my blood because my iron level is too low.
Uh-oh.
I tried bolstering the iron level myself, and I was up to 130 milligrams of iron in the AM and 130 in the PM, and it raised havoc with my stools, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I'll bet.
So, it was not funny. But anyway, so what do you recommend to bolster the iron level?
Well, the question is it just the ferritin, or is it also your hemoglobin, hematocrit?
I don't know.
Okay, that's
all
important
they do
to know.
Is they just poke your finger, and they poke your finger, and they put that little spot of blood in their little test machine, and they say, okay.
Uh-huh.
You need to be at 13, and you're at 11.9 or 12.6.
Okay, so they're measuring hemoglobin. Yeah, they're measuring your hemoglobin levels. Okay, that is a concern, and so it's not necessarily iron deficiency. Okay, when they're doing just that little spot test, we've got three different things we look at. One is ferritin, which actually is a protein complex that carries iron in our system. So your ferritin levels is an indirect indicator of how much iron you've actually got circulating. The next one we look at is hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is the molecule in a red blood cell that actually carries the oxygen to the tissues. So it picks up the oxygen in your lungs. When the right side of your heart pumps that blood up through the lungs, you release the carbon dioxide to exhale, and you bring oxygen in, and then that hemoglobin carries it out and releases it in your tissues. The third thing we're looking at is called the hematocrit, and that is the percentage of your red blood, of your blood volume that is made up of red blood cells. Okay. So hematocrit percentage of your blood volume that is red cells, hemoglobin, the amount of the molecule that actually carries the oxygen, ferritin, direct measurement of the carrying capacity of iron in your system. The problem is in a man who's over 50 to 60, and judging from the tenor of your voice, you are a man of some mature years. You're no longer those youth.
I'm only 81.
Yeah. I try to be polite and say a man of your mature years.
Yes, I understand.
Okay. When older people start getting low hemoglobin levels, we have to start asking why. And iron deficiency is a common reason in younger menstruating women because they're losing blood with their menstruation every month. Men don't have that issue, and especially older men. So we start looking for where is the hemoglobin going? Are you not making enough red cells anymore? That's one set of problems. So we may have some bone marrow dyscrasias of some sort. Are you making red blood cells and now your body is breaking them down? That's another problem. Are you making enough red blood cells? They're not getting broken down, but they're leaking out somewhere. Okay, they're actually leaking out the most common place in the gut. That can be an occult ulcer disease. It can be diverticulosis. It can be colon cancer is our biggest, scariest one in the choices. So when older people start developing anemias, that is low blood counts, we have to start looking for why. And then there is the anemia of old age, sometimes called the anemia of chronic disease. As people just get old enough, sometimes their bone marrow is just not kicking out the red cells that it used to. So I guess what I'm getting to for you is, instead of me making a guess here on the radio, you need to get in and have somebody do a real workup. We need to be looking for occult blood in your stool. You know, are you leaking somewhere in your gut? When was your last colonoscopy? You know, when did somebody take a peek in your gut to make sure we don't have a colon cancer hiding somewhere?
If I can interrupt, I just had I've done the Galleri test twice. And I think
good.
I believe in that. So, but I just had a stool sample done at the VA here about a week ago. And there's no sign of blood in the stool.
Good. Okay, those are important data points. So that makes a cancer pretty unlikely. The Galleri test will usually pick them up. Not always, but usually. You know, nothing done to or by humans is perfect. And then you've doubled down with the occult stool, occult blood in your stool, and that's not there, so that's good. So now we have to say, okay, you're not leaking blood. You don't have a cancer that's doing it to you, probably. So what's going on with your bone marrow? You know, do you have an autoimmune process where you're breaking red cells down? Be odd in your 80s to develop a new immune process, so that's low risk, but not impossible. Then the next one we get is, now, what's going on in your bone marrow? Why are you not producing? Or are you actually iron deficient? That's also possible. So you need to get in, have your doctor do some specific testing, okay? You need to do a ferritin. You need a complete blood count. We need to look for the size, the shape, the amount of hemoglobin we actually see in your red cells. If that doesn't give us answers, we may want to do something like an iron binding capacity or even a bone marrow biopsy to take a look at your marrow and see whether or not you're producing enough red cells. And if not, why not? So you need a workup, okay? This is too important to guess. We know it's probably not a cancer. That's good news. I love that. But now what is it? Something is keeping your hemoglobin low, and we need a doctor who will pay attention and get in and do some testing and find out why.
And what kind of doctor?
Well, your family doc can do this if he has the interest. If you want a specialist, it would be a hematologist.
Okay, hematologist.
Right.
All right. One comment I'd like to make, too, is for those that are listening, I found this study in Finland of 1,000 people, and they found that men over the age of 45 to 50 and women after menopause should donate 2 pints of whole blood per year. By doing so, it reduces the risk of heart attack and stroke by 45 to 88%.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons I continue to do this. So that's it. I can get you the information on that study if you'd like.
I always like things. Okay. I learn a lot from my patients.
All right.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for the call.
Bye-bye, sir.
All right. Goodbye, Richard. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of your phone calls at 1-800-465-8770. Eli will talk with you next on Leading Edge Medicine. Stay right there. Want you to feel good. That's what the show is all about. Leading Edge Medicine. of course, brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinics, and we're going to talk more about that in just a few moments. Taking some phone calls. Dr. Mixon, are you ready for another one?
Let's do it to it.
Okay, we have Eli calling in from Redmond this morning. Hi, Eli.
Good morning, Hello. Eli.
Good morning. I have a twofold question. I've been a patient there since the late 90s, so I probably have more tenure than most of the people who work there now, except for Jerry Mixon.
That's true.
Yes.
But I'm going to be turning 77 here shortly. And I had a recent diagnosis of prostate cancer, and it's an adenocarcinoma. And so, you know, there was stage 3 contained in the prostate, hadn't discovered. So I had to take a PET scan because I have a defibrillator implanted in my chest.
Uh-huh.
And I recently discovered, after talking with my cardiologist this week, I told him that, and he says, well, your defibrillator is MRI compatible. I said, what? I never heard of that. And so I said, you mean I could have taken an MRI? And so my only question is, you know, would I die if they mislabeled it? If it's, you know, by mistake, it's not a MRI compatible or what? I mean, what's the possibility of that? And then secondly, I discovered also, I recently talked Dr. Brazel into giving me rapamycin, and And I was going to go to the, regular Medicare with the Medigap policy, and discovered that if you take rapamycin, you no longer qualify for a Medigap policy.
How come?
So I don't know. That's what I was going to ask you. Why would that be something just
all
a
right.
low
well,
dose?
I can think of some reasons, but all right.
Okay.
I was curious, what was their reason? But as usual with insurance companies, they don't give you a reason, right?
Right.
All right. Just trust us. We
yes.
know best about your body.
Because we say so.
God, right. They treat us like we're 3 years old. Okay. Well, first of all, the only FDA-approved use for rapamycin is organ transplants, okay, to suppress rejection of organ transplants. Ergo, according to the insurance company, if you are on rapamycin, you must be carrying around somebody else's kidney or lung or whatever. And that puts you at extremely high risk of running up big, big medical bills. And so they don't want you on their Medigap program. Okay. They want you to be picking up at least 20% of the cost of that through Medicare straight. So, okay. All right. Yeah, and that's an issue. But I don't know what to do about it. That's just their rules, and I can't change their rules. I do sometimes look at their rules and feel like slapping somebody upside the head, but then I'd rather not go to jail for assault, so I probably won't do that either. So what do we do? Well, personally, it's more important for me to be on my rapamycin than to be on my Medigap, but I have to also admit I've never mentioned to my insurance company that I'm on rapamycin. So.
Yeah, that's what Brapel said. She said, why did you tell them that? I said, well, I didn't know it was going to be a problem.
Yeah. You know, Longevity Medical Clinic is one of the last clinics in the country that actually provides patient confidentiality. The change we had when HIPAA came into play and when Obamacare came into play is that now anybody who has a financial stake in your medical care has access to your medical records. Even the IRS has access to your medical records, which is bizarre to me. So insurance companies, IRS, any government agency, anybody on planet Earth that can make a plausible case for having a financial stake in your health and get access to your medical records. I think that's an abomination. This should be something secret between the doctor and the patient. And, you know, we don't tell anybody anything about your medical care, not your husband, not your wife, not your children, certainly not the government, unless you tell us in writing to tell them about it. Okay.
Okay.
So that's important to me. I think patient confidentiality is critically important for the doctor-patient relationship. People tell their doctors things they won't even tell their priest. So we need to earn that level of trust from our patients.
Okay.
At any rate, you've told them they won't give you the Medigap, so we're stuck. Yeah. Now I have run off on such a tangent, I've totally forgotten what it was that you called me about in the first place. So,
yeah.
Recap.
The other one was that with the cancer diagnosis on the prostate, the doctors at Fred Hutch immediately said, stop taking your testosterone. They said it fuels the cancer growth in there. So I said, that's fine. And so I stopped taking my testosterone supplement. And the other thing I was wondering is, if this transplanted defibrillator, pacemaker, is not MIR compatible, let's say they made a mistake in labeling it, would I die if I had got an MRI? Because I've been taking, I took the PET scan not knowing that it was MIR compatible.
You could. And one of Dr. Mixon's many aphorisms about medicine and life, nothing done to or by human beings is perfect. Is it likely that it got mislabeled? No. No.
Okay.
The fail-safes around implantable pacemakers are extremely rigorous. Not only do they not make very many mistakes about the type of the individual pacemaker is serial number and recorded. So they not only know the type of pacemaker, they know which pacemaker they put in you. And they can trace that all the way back to the factory. Because if there's ever a pacemaker malfunction, this is one of those things that the government, the insurance companies, and the pacemaker manufacturers really want to know about. Okay. So the odds on you having a mislabeled pacemaker are virtually as close to zero as we get in this world.
Okay.
So I would not be overly concerned about that.
Okay. So should I request an MRI now, even though I've had the PET scan, so that they can go forward with the treatment protocol with radiation instead of a prostatectomy?
Yeah, but what you want to do is you have your cardiologist talk to your radiologist, talk to your oncologist, okay?
Okay.
So that they need to share information and make sure that everybody is on the same page.
Okay.
The other thing we're looking at is which strength of MRI we're talking about. I have had several 1.5 Tesla MRIs. The strength of the MRI magnets is measured in units of Teslas, okay, after Nikolai Tesla. The 1.5 has always in the past been the most powerful one. They now have a 3 Tesla machine out. I've had 1.5 Tesla MRIs, but I recently had wanted to get a 3 Tesla total body MRI, starting at my head, looking at my brain, going all the way to my toes to pick up anything that might have previously been missed. Just because this is one of those things insurance wouldn't cover, but I figure I'm worth it. But because of my old shrapnel, my old gunshot and shrapnel wounds, they wouldn't do it. They'll do a 1.5 Tesla, but they wouldn't do a 3 Tesla because they were afraid that it might move some of my old metal fragments that are scattered hither and yon and cause me some problems.
Okay.
So I'd have your cardiologist and your radiologist comparing notes and making sure that they're both comfortable with the particular MRI machine they're going to use on you. Because 3 Teslas are touchier than 1.5s. They're twice as strong as magnets. And so what might be a safe device in a 1.5 might not be for a 3.
Gotcha. Okay. That's good to know. Thank you so much for that. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mixon. I've always been able to depend on you. For the day I met you, in the days when you were doing seminars in the hotels.
Well, I tell you,
you gave me some advice that that I couldn't get anywhere else. So
we are still looking at picking up some live seminars again. We wanted to do one early in this year, and we've had to put it off a bit. But I would love to do some longer seminars on specific subjects. I would love to do, for instance, seminars for prostate cancer victims, for breast cancer victims, for people with specific problems that that we might be able to help. I'd love to do a seminar on reversing cardiovascular disease, because we can actually open up those arteries over the course of a year to 18 months, rather than having people just being treated and treated and treated while the disease slowly progresses. So, at some point this year, I'd love to set up a seminar schedule, maybe only three or so during the course of the year on particular subjects. I just think those would be beneficial for people. So.
Oh, yeah, I found it very beneficial, and I bragged about you so much that I probably made people crazy. But
I need to put you on payroll.
There you go, Eli.
Get you in the marketing department.
Well, yes.
All right.
Okay, Eli, thank you very much for the call, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson.
Oh.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call. Time for at least one or two more calls at 1-800-465-8770. That's the number to call in. We're headed to Gig Harbor right now, Dr. Mixon. We have Mark on the line.
Hello, Mark.
Welcome, Mark.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, sir. How can I help?
I was going to say, today must be the day for prostate questions. So this is where I'm at. Been having my PSA numbers checked, and they, in the past, they've run like around 5.5, 5.6, and then they jumped up about 6 months ago to 8.5. Mm. So my urologist, wanted me to get a MRI, so I did that, and that came back. He said I had... It showed something there.
Okay.
And so now he wants to, and he gave it a score of 4, like from 1 to 5, it's a 4. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that means.
Okay.
But he wants me to go have a biopsy. And I was just curious, I've been hearing about this Galleri test. Is a Galleri test, would that be of any benefit as far as, Is it good for prostate cancer detection? Or
your MRI, your PSA, your rising PSA says that you have increased metabolic activity from your prostate. Okay, it can be from inflammation, it can be from a tumor growing, it can be for a variety of reasons. But it always makes us suspicious when we see a rapidly rising PSA that there might be a prostate cancer there. You put that together with a positive MRI that says there is a discernible lesion they can see. That tells me that your biopsy is really needed. The nice thing about a MRI-directed biopsy is we now know where the bad, the suspicious lesion is. And so when they do the biopsy, they'll go right into the area where they think there's something suspicious and get a piece of that tissue. That then will give us far more information than the Galleri test would give us. Okay, Galleri is a screening test. It tells us we're getting proteins consistent with a tumor, and then it can narrow down the organ system at which there might be a tumor. But then you always want to go in and do more specific tests. You're already past the Galleri stage. You're looking at a specific test now that will not only tell us is there a likelihood that you've got a prostate cancer, but then it'll let them get a piece of tissue they can do genetic studies on and tell you with a high degree of probability how dangerous this particular lesion might be. So, no, go get your biopsy. You're moving in the right direction. I think Your doctor is doing everything that I would recommend. Of course, you got to recognize he's the specialist and I'm not, so my approval probably means very little. But
what is the four out of five score that he gave it?
He's basically saying he thinks there's a high probability that there is a cancer there. He doesn't know for sure, but he thinks there's a high probability. So then what he wants to do is to get a piece of that tumor or get a piece of that abnormal tissue, confirm, is it indeed a cancer? And if so, he'll then assign a Gleason score. And that Gleason score is run up to 10. A 6 is a mild, low-grade, probably not very dangerous cancer. A 7 is a little higher risk. But even with a Gleason 6 or 7, about 93% of the time, those can just be watched with a series of MRIs and PSAs to see if it is continuing to grow. About 93% of the time, those tumors that are a 6 or 7 Gleason will not grow or cause you any problem. They can often be watched for up to 15 years with no real danger. It's that other 7% that scares us. It's that other 7% we want to make sure that somebody is keeping close eye on or needs to be removed. If you're a Gleason 8, 9, or 10, now we've got some real worries. So first the biopsy, get your Gleason score, and then we can make more rational decisions about where we need to go from there.
Okay, I know that would also, one of the factors would be my age. I'm still in my early 60s, so...
Yes, younger you are, the more we worry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if it is cancerous, is there more options than just prostate removal?
Yes.
As far as treatment?
Yes, there are. There's a lot of options these days, and depending on where it's located... And that's one of the nice things about the MRI. The MRI tells us in advance where we're looking. If you've got one that's low down, you can often have people go in with either lasers or cryotherapies and just remove that portion of the prostate that has the cancer located. If it's a small localized tumor, you often don't have to lose the whole prostate. You can just lose part of the prostate. These are more restricted interventions. If you've got a more difficult location of the tumor or a larger tumor, then we've got things such as the radioactive beads. We've got proton therapies where the proton radiation as opposed to gamma radiation will give us a very, very localized beam and only destroy that part of the prostate we want to destroy. You've got external beam radiation as opposed to the seeds we actually put in the prostate. So you've got a higher dose, shorter therapies versus low dose, longer periods of therapy that tend to have fewer side effects, fewer radiation damage to bowel and bladder and so on. There's a lot of different ways to approach this tumor now. So there's even some immunotherapies being developed. So it's a really different milieu for prostate therapy from what it was even 10 or 15 years ago. But step one, let's make the diagnosis. Let's be sure what we're dealing with. Okay?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your input. I guess
I'll
call back once I have more info.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for the call, Mark. Yeah,
Before we move on to another caller.
Yes.
I'm going to jump back to a previous prostate caller.
Okay.
I was a little distressed to hear that the oncologist over at the Hutch was so opposed to testosterone. We've known since the 1990s that testosterone does not cause prostate cancers. In fact, men with high testosterone loads tend to get slower growing, less invasive tumors than people with low testosterone. I know oncologists, cancer doctors now, who will tell their patients, no, don't go off your testosterone. It has no impact on how our outcomes are. Our treatments are every bit as good. In fact, I know one doctor who swears that men who are on testosterone supplementation do better and have lower reoccurrences than people that are not getting testosterone. So that old thing about if you got a prostate cancer, you have to go off testosterone is being called into question. Now, there are some prostate cancers where we certainly do want to inhibit testosterone for some period of time. But even then, it's not necessarily a long-term sort of process. So this is in a state of flux. There are doctors who disagree on both sides of that. And I'm talking about oncologists, cancer doctors, that feel strongly on one way or the other. Personally, I'm kind of ambivalent. I listen to doctors who argue one way and then doctors the other argue the other way, and my opinion will change depending on how persuasive the cancer doctor is. So, you know, I think when anybody talks about prostate cancer and testosterone, we need to recognize that there are opinions on both sides of the issue these days, and they are in flux. And I'm not sure how it's going to shake out over the next 5 or 10 years. So, you know, don't get too panicky too fast.
Okay.
That's where I'm going to leave that one for now.
All right. And we have one last prostate question for you today, because today has been the show for prostate questions.
It seems to be, yeah.
All right. We have Lee calling in from Alberta. Hi there, Lee.
Hello, Lee. How can we help?
Well, I have Canadian ancestry, but I'm actually in Melbourne and Washington. So,
oh, there you are.
Not
okay.
Too far from Alberta.
Not too far. A little less so, snow today, too.
Yes, exactly. The Tesla 1.5, and then you mentioned the 3. Are those the same thing as the a T2 or a T3 MRI?
Yes, that's
same
right.
Same correlation,
yes.
Just different language? Okay, great.
Yeah, you got a T1.5, T2, T3.
Yeah, okay.
The T stands for Tesla.
So,
go ahead.
I figured as much at when I heard you started talking about that, but I'd never heard you mention the Tesla word before. Anyways, that aside, gosh, I don't know if we got enough time here. Hopefully, why do some stools float and others sink in when you're going number two?
Okay.
That's question of gas and fat. And then, okay, I'm sorry, what?
How much gas and how much fat is contained in the stool?
How much? Dense, I heard you say how much fat, but I didn't hear the other part.
Oh, gas. G-A-S.
Oh, gas. Okay, I got you.
Okay. Fluffy, light, not very dense stools that have a lot of gas component or a lot of fat component will float. So those that are dense,
I was kind of wondering if it had something to do with mineral content. And so the more mineral in the stool, the heavier it was. But okay, cool. I mean, I probably could have Googled that or YouTubed it, but you're the expert. And then, you know, for a man of 7 decades in great health, people usually think I'm early 50. Lean muscle mass, good health all the way around. Always lived that way. I'm just wondering, and I do supplement magnesium, high quality D3, K2, zinc, copper, vitamin C, regimen every day mixed in with my fruit and yogurt every morning.
Good.
Usually wake up with a homemade latte and, you know, that pretty much will get things going. And then periodically throughout the day, because I do have a, you might recall, I do have that primary, I got the prostate condition I don't know what it's called. I forget. But anyways, okay. I take 5 milligrams of tadalafil to help with that almost every day. But it just seems like of recent, and I don't know how of recent, I'll have an urgency to pee, and then if I'm in somewhere when I feel like, this is probably more than pee, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to do number one and number two at the same time. And that could happen 2 to 3 times a day. Is there anything abnormal about that? Or is there any correlation to frequent pooping 3 to 4 times a day in relationship to any kind of a prostate condition?
Okay. No, the bowel function is probably not related to the prostate. But benign prostatic hypertrophy is what you're probably taking the tadalafil for. And, you know, that usually helps. Unfortunately, you're right. We are out of time. That music says we got to quit and we have to go off this station on to the next station here in a couple of
months. But you could call back on our other show and I'll have our producer give you that phone number because we are out in just a few seconds.
That's right. So get that other number from the producer. Give us a call and we can chat about it at length. Okay?
All right. Thank you for the call. And we'll see you next week right here on Leading Edge Medicine. Thank you for listening.